Live from Petonia, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Good afternoon, good morning, wherever you may be. You have stumbled across the Cinematica Podcast. This is our weekly roundup of reviews, news and opinion about the world of cinema, helping guide you through the jungle of current and latest cinema releases and get the best value out of your cinema dollar. And not just your cinema dollar, but your time. We know that time is money, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit later on. My name is Dan Slevin, and I'm here in the Cinematica studio with...
I'm Simon Weary.
And Kaylee Carruthers.
Welcome. And every week, we three will be here to review all of the latest releases, talk to interesting people about what they've been watching, and keep a close eye on what's happening around the world. Films and stories that we are looking forward to. And in today's program, we have Kaylee talking about Fright Night. She skipped off work this morning to go and talk about, to go and see that. I wonder whether she got... a note from her manager in order to do that. Simon's going to be talking about driving. I have got a lesson in political economy from the New Zealand film director Andrew Nicol. We'll have some news headlines a little bit later on as well. And Simon was very, very excited to check out the number one film in the British box office, the Inbetweeners movie. So we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. And Kaylee, you're a romantic, aren't you?
Yes.
So she's the expert on the romantic, not a comedy, it's not a rom-com, romantic drama One Day with Anne Hathaway and Jim Sturgess. So those are the films we'll be talking about this week. So why don't we start with a little bit of news. What have New Zealanders been watching at the box office this weekend, Kaylee?
All right. Well, this weekend's top five. Coming in at number five is Raw One, which is a Bollywood film. Unfortunately, we didn't get time to see it this week.
Well, here's an excellent question for all of you listeners. Bollywood films, should we be including the Bollywood movies? Because they're such huge box office in New Zealand still. Should we be including them? Should we be making that extra effort to incorporate them into the Cinematica podcast? Or should we even have a separate episode once a week dedicated to them?
I think we need to get involved. We need to get either our own episode dedicated to it, or else we need to get out there and start reviewing those films.
Mm. Indeed. All right. That was the executive producer of the show, Simon Weary, making his feelings known. And you can contact us at CinematicaCast on Twitter and maybe let us know how you feel about that.
All right. And continuing with the top five, coming in at number four is Midnight in Paris. Number three, Paranormal Activity 3. Number two, the Inbetweeners movie. And number one, the new Justin Timberlake hit movie, In Time.
And we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. But first, it's the day, here in New Zealand, it is the day after Halloween, a festival. We've just been talking prior to going on air about how New Zealanders have embraced this pretty much totally commercial festival now. And there were kids up and down the country traipsing across streets with trick-or-treats and costumes and what have you. And that means that at Halloween time, a lot of the big horror movies get released. And the first one we're going to talk about is Fright Night.
I'll tell you this, but that guy, your neighbor?
Jerry.
Yeah, he's a vampire.
That is a terrible vampire name. Jerry?
Kaylee, you saw Fright Night this morning, and you saw it in broad daylight, pretty much. Did it still affect you?
Well, you know, since starting the Cinematica podcast, I feel a bit of a vampire because I'm in the cinema so much. But so I felt I really connected with the characters in this film.
Never going out in daylight.
Yeah.
Sleeping
exactly.
In a coffin.
Yeah, exactly. So anyway, Fright Night stars Anton Yelchin, very talented young man, and he leads a fine cast of Vegas suburbanites who discover a vampire has moved into the neighborhood and their friends and family start disappearing mysteriously.
don't they just? And nobody seems to care. This is one of the interesting things about the film, I thought, was that setting it in Las Vegas, which is this community of people that come and go and, you know, they turn up at school, they disappear, they move to other towns, etc. And also it's a completely nocturnal city for all intents and purposes. People work at night and they sleep all day. They have the blinds drawn permanently. So what better place for a vampire to hang out than somewhere like Las Vegas? And who plays the vampire?
That is played by Colin Farrell. And I'm getting big thumbs up from Simon, but quite honestly, Colin Farrell's the last person that I want to spend 2 hours in the dark with.
Oh,
that's harsh. That hurts.
I do not like Colin Farrell.
I love Colin Farrell. I think he's awesome.
I thought he was pretty good in this. Okay, so let's assume that we're outvoting you on the Colin Farrell department. Keep going.
Right. So yeah, it was really fun. I really enjoyed myself. I wasn't so sure going into it. I'm a huge zombie fan. I'm actually a bit of a zombie kind of nerd. I wrote a paper on zombie stuff. But anyway, but I really enjoyed myself kind of despite my intentions. And there's a great, great character in this film who's a vampire slayer, and it's played by the one and only David Tennant.
That's right, the Scottish Doctor Who of recent times.
Yeah, so it's awesome. So you can't really recognize him when you first meet him, but then all of a sudden, Doctor Who is here to save the day.
That was a quite staggering moment for me because he was under a whole lot of makeup for his first appearances in the film, and I was thinking, who is that? Trying to work out who it is, and then he starts peeling off wigs and what have you, and it was a really big surprise. I just obviously hadn't read the press kit before going to see the film, so it's a totally understandable surprise. How was the 3D?
The 3D was really good. I originally wasn't sure about seeing it in 3D, but I was actually quite impressed. It being a vampire film, there is some gore in it, but they use the 3D quite effectively, and it's a really entertaining kind of teen film, and it's based on an original Hollywood 1980s horror film, and I think they kept some of that 80s camp throughout it, which I really appreciated.
And I think that people who are fans of the original will probably find that there were quite a few references back to the original film. I, like a lot of these big 80s movies, I've talked to on the show before about how I haven't seen Top Gun and various films like that. I haven't seen The Goonies either. Is that, am I allowed to?
My mother is so unimpressed with you right now.
Man, you've got to see The Goonies.
And I haven't seen Fright Night either, the original. So I'm just taking it entirely on its individual 21st century merits.
It was an awesome film, the original. I loved it. Yep. And I'm going to rush out there this weekend and see this one because I think you've inspired me.
Yeah. So a two-word summary?
Fun gore.
My two-word summary is not crap.
If I drive for you, you give me a time and a place. I give you a five-minute window. Anything happens in that 5 minutes and I'm yours, no matter what. I don't sit in while you're running it down. I don't carry a gun. I drive.
Simon, you love driving. I've seen your wheels, man. You love hooning around the hut. Drive. What did you make of it?
It's a superb film, I thought. Like, I really enjoyed it. The pace of it, the acting, everything to do with it, it's sort of very kind of impressive and very well paced, and the style and I guess, you know, it is. It's a very cool film. It's uber cool.
It is uber cool. It's capital C cool, isn't it? What's it about, Simon?
Well, it's about
do any of us even know?
Well, it's about a Hollywood sort of stunt driver who sort of moonlights at night, sort of helping out bank heists and things like that, and being the driver. He's just the driver. He drives. He does nothing else. Doesn't have any other connection to it. And but along the way, he meets his neighbour, and it sort of carries on from there about this relationship that he develops with her. And it's almost like there's these two souls that are kind of a bit lost, and they really connect. And so it has that aspect to it, which is very strong.
Yeah, and he gets involved, doesn't he, because her husband is in prison, and when her husband comes out of prison, he is tapped up by a whole lot of people to do one final job to get himself out of debt, doesn't want to do it, gets the crap kicked out of him, frankly, and so driver, in order to protect the woman that he loves, even though she's sort of spoken for, decides that he's going to save the day and basically protect the family and help this guy. But it all goes wrong, doesn't it?
Very much so,
a lot of heist films, it goes wrong. And it's for me, it's a film about the pointlessness of making plans, really. because nothing will go according to them. The guy who made it, Nicholas Winding Refn, is a Danish director, and he made a series of films called the Pusher Trilogy, which are incredibly violent and incredibly powerful. He also made a film that was in the World Cinema Showcase here in New Zealand last year called Bronson, which was an extraordinarily powerful film. He's a gifted filmmaker. But what really surprised me about Drive was how much more heart he managed to bring to the story and the characters, even though it's a very austere film. You know, there's no wasted dialogue, it's not a very emotional film, and yet you've got a real sense that about the connections that were being forged between these characters. The other thing,
I found it very emotional in the sense that I felt like exhausted at the end of it. You know, like emotionally, I thought it was very powerful in that respect. You know, I really, and it was a film that I went away from perhaps thinking about a few instances and like certain events, but then later on, a week later, 2 weeks later, it was just this feeling that comes through and the imagery that comes through from the film, which just, you know, really holds. It's very strong.
Talking of imagery, it could almost be a 1980s movie, couldn't it? Everything, I know that people are going to be writing academic theses on just the use of the font at the beginning of it and the colours, and it reminded me of films like American Gigolo with Richard Gere, or To Live and Die in L.A. And that was something else that I thought was really, really good, was it took Los Angeles seriously. It treated Los Angeles like a character, and that whole Southern California, the Valley, Echo Park, places like that. And you got a sense that this wasn't just any town USA. This was the kind of story that could only really take place in a place where the glamour of Hollywood is on one side of a continuum, and at the other end, you've got people really struggling to make ends meet.
Yeah, but neither are portrayed in a way that's kind of glamorous or picture perfect. It's quite gritty.
It's gritty. It's grimy. Exactly, and it's all just hard work. What do we think of Ryan Gosling? Isn't he amazing?
He's fantastic. And I mean, Keri Mulligan, I thought that was quite an inspired choice for her to do that sort of role. You know, and she really, really foots it with him. She's just impressive.
I think everybody in it is magnificent. Albert Brooks, who is best known as a comedian and has made some films of his own as a sort of nerdy, Jewish, nebbishy sort of kind of a Woody Allen character in a lot of the films that he's made. He's playing the villain in this picture.
And he's a villain.
Isn't he just? Ooh. He is mean. Mm. And I think that I think for a lot of people who may have just seen the poster or the trailers, I think the trailer can be a little bit misleading. I think you do get a sense that it'll be perhaps a little bit more of an action movie than it is. There are some great action set pieces, and it's incredibly tense, but it's also got a kind of European art house sensibility about it as well. So I think that people who love cinema, as we do, Cinematica after all is the name of the podcast, we absolutely adored it. So have we got a two word summing up for Kaylee?
Yes, hot action.
Totally awesome.
And for me, almost genius.
How old are you?
28.
I'm 105. But the day comes when you've had enough. If you had as much time as I have, what would you do with it?
Sure as hell wouldn't waste it.
The last time anyone saw him alive, there was over a century on that clock.
Well, follow the time.
His name is Will Salas.
You can't hide 100 years in the ghetto.
You know that time will get you killed.
Hey, Mom, I'm gonna get out of here.
I just wouldn't know what to do if I lost you.
That was an extract from, a couple of extracts actually, from the film In Time, which is the new film starring Justin Timberlake and Amanda Seyfried. And it is, I think this is the one for me, isn't it? This is the one that I'm going to talk about. Right. It's written and directed by a guy called Andrew Niccol, who probably best known for a film called Gattaca a few years ago, and also a film called Simone, which wasn't quite as successful. He's a New Zealander, former New Zealand advertising guy, actually. Went to America to make his fortune as a screenwriter and as a director. And he always seems to have, or attempt to have, his finger on the pulse of whatever appears to be a big issue, a big science fiction discussion. Or, you know, Gattaca was about genetic engineering and genetic modification. Simone was about cloning. And this film, In Time, is sets up a potential future for humanity where, due to genetic engineering, we can all be 25 years old forever. We never age beyond 25. The only wrinkle in this matchless plan is that you can only live for a year after you get to 25 unless you earn more time. So time literally becomes money. You go to work and you get paid in hours, minutes, seconds that get added to a clock that is embedded in your wrist. So you always know how long you've got to live unless you can add some more time to it. Now, this is quite an excellent little conundrum that he set for himself here, and you think this is kind of interesting. Not only has he set this up, but he's also got basically, it's a lecture in Marxist political economy, because the super rich live forever and they have their own sort of enclave right in the heart of the city. There are barriers and gates and what they call time zones that the poor people can't get to them. And they are in control of the economy. They're in control of manufacturing and business, and they lend time to people at extraordinary interest rates. They're constantly raising the price of things so that people can't afford to continue to live, basically. And so the idea is that the rich get richer at the expense of the poor. The poor can't afford to live anymore. And so in order for the rich, the super rich, to be immortal, because time is a finite commodity like money is, the poor have to basically run out of gas. And so Justin Timberlake, one of the things that turns him against, you know, he becomes a freedom fighter for this, to try and bring down the state, is that his mother, who is played by Olivia Wilde, I think it is, who looks exactly the same age as him, because of course everybody in the film looks 25 years old, she dies before her time because somebody has decided that the bus fares need to go up, and so she can't afford to get on the bus to go to meet him to get some time from him in order to be able to live, right? So he's completely upset about this and decides that he is going to turn things around. He also meets a mysterious wealthy person who is over, as we heard in the trailer there, is over 100 years old but is tired of living to no purpose, and decides that he's going to give Justin Timberlake his 100 years, and he throws himself off a bridge. So Timberlake's got 100 years. What's he going to do with it? He's going to try and bring down the system. And so this is actually, I get the feeling, for a lot of and audiences who perhaps aren't particularly sophisticated economically speaking are going to watch this film, and hopefully they'll make the connections. Time equals money, and they're going to rise up. They're going to join the Occupy Wall Street people. They're going to start marching on the super rich and demand their fair share, because that's really what the film's arguing about. And so it's not a particularly sophisticated analysis, but it does have a position, and I think it hopefully might change a few people's minds. That was a very long rant, wasn't it?
It's good. So if you're not sure what it's about, you can just rewind and listen to it. But it is.
You might have to pause between sentences and go, "What on earth was that last bit about?"
It was great. That was very succinct.
Well, and quite sort of timely, isn't it? When you've got people outside Wall Street and you've got people sort of saying how much is enough and all these sorts of things going on, it's actually quite visionary in a way that it took 3 or 4 years to make.
Exactly. Well, that's the thing. It's absolutely nailed the zeitgeist. It seemed, if it had come out 6 months either side, who knows whether it would have actually been as timely or as pertinent as it's become. Have either of you guys seen it?
Yes.
Yes. What did you think, Kaylee?
Well, I thought it was lots of fun. I managed to drag a friend along to it on a Friday night, and it was entertaining. We both came out thinking that, you know, the story could have gone a bit deeper. It could have been a little bit more intelligent. So that was kind of one issue. It's quite surface, but, you know, it's dealing with a big hot political issue at the time. And my other kind of issue with it was that whole no one ages past 25 and no one's over a size 6. So I had these kind of like radars going off in my head being like, oh, wait a second, the entire world has turned into ideal Hollywood, and it's kind of making me sick right now.
And they're all pretty white as well, apart from one of the cops.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I I wasn't that impressed with it as filmmaking, unfortunately. I admired the stance, the political stance, and I hope that it has an effect in sort of nudging people's thoughts in one way or another. But unfortunately for me, the plot was just so full of holes that there was quite often I was just going, now hold on a second. How did he... Because, Kaylee, and you'll remember this, the very first time he goes into New Greenwich, which is where the rich people live, he has to go through about 8 different barriers to go through 8 different time zones, and he has to pay to go through every single one. But after that, he seems to be able to come and go pretty much as he pleases. He doesn't have to pay the tolls anymore. And so it's like, well, is it hard to get between the two, or is it easy? So that was just one example of a lot of times where I just thought, oh, now hold on, you haven't really followed this through totally. What did we think of Justin Timberlake? Is he becoming the leading man that the Mickey Mouse Club really wanted him to be?
You know what? I will admit, I saw Justin Timberlake live. I saw his performance of the Future Sex Love show when it came to Vancouver. And he's great on stage, not so much on screen.
Yeah, he hasn't quite got it yet, has he? He hasn't quite got that leading man weight. Interestingly enough, Ryan Gosling, also a former member of the Mickey Mouse Club, along with Britney and a few others like that. So, you know, that Disney's still doing its bit to sort of identify the young talent and bring them on. But Ryan Gosling's something else. He is not, and Justin Timberlake hasn't quite made it.
So,
Simon, you're looking at me like you want to say something.
No, not at all. No, I'm getting.
Oh, your eyes just glazing.
No, I'm quite keen to go and check that out now, because you've really kind of sold to me as a kind of a sort of critique on sort of free market sort of forces.
And, yeah, I think so. It's definitely a very political film.
Right. So, Dan, what is your 2-word review?
Occupy Hollywood. And Kaylee, yours?
Average fluff.
All right, it's time for some news.
All right, well, it's Kaylee here again with your news. So this week, this Saturday, actually, in Wellington, the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra are presenting a special screening of Fritz Lang's Metropolis with the original score by Gottfried Huppertz. Did I say that correctly?
Sounds good enough to me.
Yeah, good.
And that was the original music that Lang actually intended when he was making the film, rather than the Giorgio Moroder version from the 80s. And there'll be another presentation in Auckland following the Saturday. Details will be on our website in the show notes.
And where is our website?
Our website, which launched this week. Very exciting. It's cinematica.co.nz.
There we go. Cinematica.co.nz. It's got a whole lot of news that we spot as it filters through during the week. As well as you can hear all of our podcasts archived there, and show notes for each of our shows will also be featured there. So anything that we talk about, generally speaking, you should be able to find a follow-up to it there. Now, the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra were kind enough to actually send me some music for Metropolis, so we can have a bit of a listen. I'm really looking forward to this on Saturday, actually. I'm going to be going along. A full symphony orchestra backing possibly the most amazing silent movie ever made. And, you know, here in Wellington, we don't get the big full orchestra silent movie treatment anymore, because the Embassy Theatre, which is where we used to have those gigs, got refurbished a few years ago, and there's no orchestra pit anymore for them. So when silent movies play in Wellington, we get a little piano player in the corner. So this is a really good opportunity to hear some full orchestra supporting Metropolis. Here's a little bit of the music. Very much looking forward to seeing that on Saturday night. And as I say, the following Saturday in Auckland, that's actually not the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra version. That's Frank Strobel and the Berlin Radio Symphony Orchestra, but it is basically the same thing.
All right. And also in the news, an amazing story from the Ukraine. 5 years ago, a demented film director took over an entire city to start filming an epic movie that has taken on a life of its own. Something like Synecdoche, New York, only for real. This full amazing story is in this month's GQ magazine and online, and we will put the link in the show notes.
It is quite an amazing story, and because, 5 years, and the entire city has been roped in to make this film. They've all got parts, and he's sort of filming the making of it as he goes along. It's demented, and the kind of thing that, you know, we think Wellington's a one industry town now that The Hobbit is back in production. You should check this out. It is amazing. Were you pointing at me at this point? Okay. More New Zealand movie news now. Roger Donaldson's getting to make a new film. It's called Cities. It's going into production next year. And Roger Donaldson, the maker of The World's Fastest Indian and the Kiwi classic Sleeping Dogs, it's an international thriller. Orlando Bloom's going to be in it. Kirsten Dunst is in it. And Clive Owen, who I used to really dislike, but I've sort of come around to. I was reading some of my old reviews of Children of Men. Was almost one of the first films that I reviewed, and I did describe him as Plank-like.
He always feels like he just turned up.
But I'm coming around to him now. Maybe there's a subtlety there that I didn't get first up, but he certainly doesn't put a huge amount of energy into his roles. Anyway, Clive Owen and Anil Kapoor is in it as well, so it's not really a Kiwi film apart from the fact that Donaldson wrote it and is going to direct, but it is being produced by iWorks, which is a company that was founded by New Zealand reality TV creator Julie Christie. There's no release date for it yet, but we'll keep you abreast of that as it comes along.
And Robert De Niro is going to be playing a comedian again, this time for Sean Penn as director instead of Martin Scorsese. The Comedian, the name of the film, shoots next year and also stars Kristen Wiig, who's one of my favorites from Saturday Night Live.
Oh, she's awesome. I think she's fantastic. And have you seen Paul?
Yes.
Yes.
Isn't she great? Yep. I loved her and Paul. I thought she was great. Sorry, I just interrupted there for a second. Is that it? We all done?
No, wait. There's one more very important piece of news that I learned today. Pauly, Donnie D, and Marky Mark, the Wahlberg brothers, have opened up a burger place in Massachusetts called Wahlburger. I need to go. This is fantastic.
Well, the question is, do they deliver?
Yes, that's a good question.
Do they personally deliver? Because you could probably eat off those abs, I would imagine.
Oh yeah, I'm already getting some good vibrations for these burgers.
Well, we have a budget that allows for it, we'll send you over there to do a review. That's the end of the news. Next.
Oh, not talking.
I think we should break up.
Now you've been dumped, we can all go on a mental holiday together. 2 weeks of sun, sea, booze, minge, fanny, and sex.
Yeah, that's probably our clean rating from iTunes just gone down the window.
Yeah, we've just spoiled Cinematica with the word minge.
That's tame.
I know, that is tame, in fact. And that film gets way more offensive than that. That was I was just hunting around for bits of audio that we could even play. The In-Betweeners movie, I don't even know where to start. I'm going to throw to you, Simon.
It's The Four Likely Lads. I mean, it's the hugely successful sitcom series in the UK, and it's The Four Likely Lads doing their big trip to the Mediterranean. What are they looking for? They're looking for
Minge and
Minge
Fanny.
And Fanny and all the rest of it. And it's... That's and then comedy ensues and craziness ensues and all these sorts of amazing gags take place, and it has some rather interesting moments.
Who are you and what have you done with Simon?
I saw 20 minutes of this a wee while ago, and I was like,
20 minutes?
Yeah. No. Before I watched it in its entirety.
You have watched it all the way through.
But you know, and I was like, I'd never heard of these guys. I'd never heard of In-Betweeners. I didn't know what this TV series was. I was like, a bit of a nerd.
No, it's a British television series, and this is an advertisement for the British abroad, isn't it, really?
Well, it is, and it's a critique in some ways. In some ways, it's that the big British trip and what takes place in the Mediterranean, and in some ways it's kind of,
It reminded me a lot of a film I saw when I was a kid, which was Are You Being Served, the movie, which was where all of the characters from the department store in Are You Being Served go away to Spain on holiday, and, of course, they don't know what a B-Day is either, and, the film, the hotel's not finished. And so the jokes in the In-Betweeners, apart from the vulgarity of them, none of them are any newer than or more original. I in my review I'm going to recycle a joke that I used yesterday in my review. I just said, New Zealand, we should just really hope that global warming doesn't make us any sunnier, because you know what will happen. The moment we get some proper sunshine, the palms will be here to drink and chase our women, and we can't be having that.
Well, it's not about the culture, is it? It's about the party. And these guys do have a rather funny party, I guess.
Okay, the most alarming aspect of the Inbetweeners movie is the fact that for 4 weeks in a row now, it has been the number one film in the UK. It's made how much money, Simon?
Well, about in the UK, I think around about 14, 15 million, which, you know, putting it in perspective is, I think, what The Dark Knight did.
And so it's inevitable now that a franchise has been created. So this is not going to be the end of this.
You're more upbeat than I was expecting.
Sorry, that didn't quite work the way I was supposed to. That was a little... There you go. There was another little bit of the trailer where the nerdy one says, well, that was a little bit more upbeat than I was expecting.
Oh, yes, and yes. And it was.
There we go. I thought we were fair, weren't we? Scrupulous.
Very
scrupulously fair.
Fair. Very fair.
So, Simon, what is your two-word review?
Oh, bit of a laugh. That's three.
No, it's okay.
Or four. That's three.
Okay, my two is absolute bollocks.
And my review is ew, no.
There we go.
When we were at university, I had a crush on you.
Well, I felt the same. The problem is I fancy pretty much everyone. It's like I've just got out of prison all the time. It's a real problem.
So.
Yes.
That was Anne Hathaway and Jim Sturridge in a little bit of One Day, which has just opened this weekend all over New Zealand and presumably around other places in the world as well. It's based on supposedly an international best-selling novel. Kaylee.
Yes. Well, let's start with the synopsis, shall we? So, One Day is about two lifelong friends who, after spending the night together on the night of their college graduation, Dexter and Em are shown each year on the same date to see where they are in their lives. So it kind of goes through time. So every year we see them together again. They're sometimes together, some days not on that same day. So it's interesting because it jumps forward through time, which is, and it's shown, it's always on the same date. And it's just basically kind of chopped together, and then you get the date comes up on the screen in some sort of kooky, creative way. And it's, you know, I didn't like it. I'm sorry. I tried. I actually almost left partway through because the character of Jim Sturgis's character of Dexter, who's supposed to...
Did I call him Sturridge before? I did, I think. Sturgis. Yeah. Sturgis. There we go. I think,
Sturridge.
Apologies. Oh. Apologies.
I'm sure he's listening. I just, you know, Jim Sturgis, who's supposed to be the main character, I just found him so unlikable. He reminded me of all these awful ex-boyfriends I had and these guys I used to chase in high school and college. And, you know, Anne Hathaway's character is just, like, always in love with him and always chasing after him. And it's just so sad. And it's like, girl, come on. You can do a lot better.
They're both pathetic, aren't they, really?
Mm.
You know, like, the one of the big problems is that he is privileged and... super rich from a big country house, public school education, pretty much has everything sort of on a plate handed to him, goes to work in television, becomes a television producer and a television star. And of course, he's so consumed by self-hatred and self-loathing that he, you know, gets into the drugs and the drink and the sex and all that sort of stuff. And you know that there's this real decent, honest, pretty girl there who's pining for him and just waiting for him to sort of come to his senses. And the thing is that, you know, you just want to give him a slap, basically. So, and yet it's his film, you know. The story really is about him finding himself while she sits around and waits for him to sort of get a grip on his life. Mm. And, Anne Hathaway's quite an appealing actor and this has star quality, you know. There's a reason why she... is so popular, and her character is a much nicer character in the film, and yet she disappears for bits and for periods of time, and we never really get a sense of what her inner life is. You know, that she is pretty much defined by the fact that she's waiting for him to come to his senses and for them to get together again. There is a twist at the end which we won't give away, but now of course you watch it and you'll be sitting waiting for the twist that we've just told you about, so that's sorry about that. But I do feel like it's a bit of a letdown, because she's the stronger character, she's the stronger actor, and yet it's about him. And what is his name?
Jim Sturgis.
He's just not a strong enough actor, really, to pull off 20 years worth of growth. His grey hair at the end was completely inauthentic.
I thought he looked a bit like you at the end.
Yeah, well, see, I've earned mine.
And the hard yards.
Yeah, that's right. And he's just had some talcum powder thrown at him. So no, I thought it was a little bit of a disappointment. But there are some. It's also wastes some very, very good supporting actors. Patricia Clarkson is in it. Interestingly, her English accent is way, way better than Anne Hathaway's. She plays his mother. Who else? Jodie Whittaker. Do you remember the film Venus with Peter O'Toole? Mm-hmm. She was the lead actor in that. Was that sort of her discovery? She's a fantastic screen presence, and yet she gets almost nothing in this film. And Romola Garai, another great, great screen actor. Again, a thankless role. I wonder whether the story is squeezed into an hour and a half and might be better. It might have been better as a TV series, where they could really get into these chapters in their lives and the supporting actors, supporting characters. So I wonder whether they've just missed the opportunity there.
Maybe. And Rafe Spall as well. He's wonderful.
Yes, Rafe Spall, Tim Spall's son. He's very good and very nice. And again, pretty much a thankless role, unfortunately. So that's how are we going to sum up One Day?
No thanks.
Noble failure.
Very good.
That's mine. So that's all of our reviews for this particular episode of the Cinematica podcast. We've raced through them. We seem to have covered an awful lot of ground. Hopefully you'll have got some clues there as to what you're going to do this weekend when it comes to going to the movies. What are we going to be doing next week?
Well, on our list next week, we will be reviewing The Thing, I Don't Know How She Does It, on Anonymous and The Debt.
Anonymous, that's already causing a lot of debate online, isn't it, about whether Shakespeare actually wrote those plays? And I think the general consensus is yes he did. The Debt, now I watched the trailer for that again over the weekend, and I don't know how you feel about it, but you know, we've talked a bit about trailers on the show and how they sometimes give too much away and sometimes mislead, but I've watched that trailer quite a few times over the last few months, and I think it does a really fantastic job of not telling you too much. It sort of sets up a situation but doesn't tell you how it's going to be resolved. It doesn't tell you how it's how the story's going to play out. You just know that there's a question and that somehow the film is going to answer it. So I'm really much very much looking forward to that. That's a new thriller directed by John Madden, I think, who made talking of Shakespeare in Love back in the day. So thank you very much, everybody, for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, do please leave us some feedback at the iTunes store. You can either rate us or review us. You also have the opportunity there to subscribe to the show. You can contact us via Twitter at CinematicaCast, which is our Twitter handle. You can go and find out more about us at cinematica.co.nz. The show is executive produced by Simon Wherry, edited and produced by me, Dan Slevin. The news editor is Kaylee Carruthers. The theme music to the show is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke. You can buy that at the iTunes store. And we're going to leave you with some more music from the original score of Metropolis. So that's good night from me.
Good night from me, Kaylee Carruthers.
And good night from me, Simon Weary.
See you same time next week.